Have you ever found yourself asking, why did I react like that? Why did that comment ruin my day? Why is this relationship looking exactly like every other relationship I've had? Have you asked yourself, why am I successful on paper but never quite at peace? What if the answer isn't your personality, your willpower, your motivation, or even your mindset? What if your brain has simply been protecting you the only way it knows how? Today, we're going to explore one of the most misunderstood topics in healthcare because what you don't know about your past might be shaping your present and your future. Welcome to Vital Signs. I'm Jen Godet, your fearless host. And today, I am joined by Dr. Ricky Greenwald, founder of the Trauma Institute and Child Trauma Institute, internationally recognized psychologist, researcher, author, and educator, whose work has helped transform how clinicians around the world understand and treat trauma. Dr. Greenwald, welcome to Vital Signs.
Thank you.
Listen, we've never talked more openly about trauma, but anxiety, depression, burnout, loneliness all continue to climb. So is it that we're understanding trauma finally? Or have we just become too quick to label everything as trauma? What is the real story? I guess the best way to frame this is, what's the misconception versus what's the reality around that word trauma?
All right. Well, I'm one of those who's guilty of labeling too many things as trauma. It's a controversy not only in the public, but also in the profession, right? So there's the DSM formal definition of, something severe, extreme, beyond the scope of normal human experience that is experienced as overwhelming and blah, blah, blah. And so, first of all, even those. They're called Criterion A, right? It's part of the diagnosis for PTSD. You have to have a Criterion A event. Even those major traumatic events that everybody agrees that's the definition of trauma are not beyond the scope of normal human experience. I'm thinking about if you look at our best protected population, kids who are raised with care and protection and support, right? They have a soccer mom. Where do you find those kids? In college, right? That's how you get, it's not the only way to get to college, but it's the main way to get to college. A study was done with college students, first year college students in an intro psych class. 84% of them, by the time they were 18 years old, had at least one major traumatic event. And that's by the time you're 18, you don't stop having experiences just because you turn 18. That's in our best protected population. And if you look at real life, not everybody gets raised with all that care and protection and support. So even major traumas like child abuse, sexual assault, severe car crash, etc., are part of the normal human experience. And that's just getting started. Then there's research on significant loss, death of a loved one, divorce, etc. And it turns out that you get more post-traumatic stress symptoms from loss than you do from trauma. With one exception, you don't get the heightened startle response from loss that you do from trauma, but you get everything else. So, and then there's more.
And
What
so it's
there?
really convoluted. This is the answer.
Well,
It's, I
what
think.
I'm doing is here's how I understand it. Not everything upsetting that happens is traumatic, right? It's the difference between I hate this, but I can handle it, or I hate this and it's too much. I can't handle it. And so what people do is they say, wait a minute, this is too much. I've got to push it out of the way just so I can do what needs to be done. And people say that all the time, right? I had to compartmentalize, right? I had to push aside my emotions so I could handle the situation. So what do? We push it aside, we put up a wall. It's there. I'm here. Now I'm good. I can get through the day. It's out of my face, right? And so that's an effective quick relief strategy. And when I ask my therapy clients about that stuff, they tell me they keep on doing it. They say, No, that doesn't bother me. I try to forget about it. I keep it out of my mind, right? So that's good, but it doesn't really disappear. It stays fresh behind the wall. So what's behind the wall? You got a jumble of stuff, images from what happened, thoughts, emotions, physical sensations. And by the way, it hurts. That's why it's behind the wall. It hurts. So you've got a wound, you've got like a sore spot behind the wall. And you're going through the day, you're minding your own business, and something this bad happens. No big deal, but it happens to hit that sore spot and it feels like this. I'll give you an example. I'm thinking of an 11-year-old boy. He's got a lot of stuff behind the wall from all those times his father told him what was wrong with him, gave him lickings. So what's behind the wall? He's got the images from what happened. People learn from experience, right? What might he have learned from those experiences? There's something wrong with me. I can't protect myself. I'm weak. All right. So he's walking down the hall in school between classes. Somebody bumps him by accident. Now, what we'd love it is if he could say, "All right, getting bumped is only this irritating. The rest of my reaction, that's just my father's stuff." Yeah, we wish, right? What happens? He said he gets bumped. He's like, "I'm being attacked." And this, I'm scared and angry and ashamed, and I can't protect myself. I feel weak. And this is too much. Why do you think I keep it behind the wall? This is too much. I know what to do. If I fill up with anger and do something aggressive, I can get rid of this scared, helpless stuff. Right? A teacher's walking by. She saw the whole thing. She drags him to the office, says he just popped somebody in the face out of the blue. He says, no, self-defense. Right? He's not lying for him. That's what happened because he thought he was being attacked. So, what the difference between I hate this and I can handle it? Is if you don't have to push it behind the wall, you can deal with it. You can kind of chew up the bites, digest it, and it becomes something you grow from, right? But if it gets pushed behind the wall, it's out of your face, you get the quick relief, but then you're walking around with a sore spot, and anything that hits that sore spot, you can have an overreaction. And I gave you an example with anger, but the sore spot can lead to an overreaction of anxiety, shame, irritation, discouragement, you name it. People who are generally competent, if something hits their sore spot, wow, it's like too much. And we all have that, you know, we all have our sore spots. So you asked a simple question like, what is trauma really? So first of all, it's the major stuff that everybody agrees is trauma. Secondly, it's the major loss that has pretty similar impact. And third, accumulation of individually minor experiences, any one of which would be annoying but no big deal. But let's say you're a kid with a learning disability and you're not getting the accommodations you need, so you keep on hitting brick walls all the time in school. Everybody else is going out to recess, you're getting in trouble because you didn't finish the assignment, one thing after another. Sooner or later, it piles up. It gets to be too much. I'm just going to push it all back there. And then one day the teacher says, open to page 16. You open to page 16. I don't get it, which would bother anybody this much. But if it hits the sore spot, it's like this. The kid throws the book down, says, this is stupid. And the teacher's like, all I did is say, open to page 16. What's going on? Right. So I use what some people would consider an overly broad definition of trauma, which is anything that got pushed behind the wall and makes the sore spot, because that's what's driving the overreactions of sadness or fear or nervousness or irritability or anger or whatever it is. So
That
that's
makes
a
sense.
long answer to a short question.
That makes total sense. And you know, like I know I hear it all the time. And it happens in entrepreneurs, and we'll explain some of the other examples as well. But it comes out as I'm just overthink things. I'm just a perfectionist. I just am not good at relationships. I don't articulate well, or whatever those beliefs are that come from that sore point. But we are getting towards the end of the segment. So I just want to sort of wrap this up in a bow for everybody who's watching. I think one of the biggest takeaways already is your brain's not trying to sabotage you. It's trying to protect you. And it's protecting you from all of those little micro occurrences, those things that added up over time that were little hurts that maybe became too overwhelming for you. And so I want to encourage everybody.
This wall is my friend. I need this wall, right?
If it's behind the wall is protecting me. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, folks, if today's conversation has you thinking differently about your experiences, I want to hear from you. Connect with me. Let me know what your feedback is. We create this show for you and for everything that we want to accomplish. And when we come back, could your body be carrying stress your mind has long since forgotten? The science behind that answer might just change how you think about physical health after these messages. Welcome back to Vital Signs. If you're just joining us, we talked about trauma. What is trauma? What could make up trauma in that trauma response, and what that might show up here today? And I want to just take up where we left off. What if some of your issues, like chronic pain, digestive issues, poor sleep, constant exhaustion, what if they're not simply physical problems? We've all heard people say, I'm just holding stress. Is it a figure of speech or is there science behind it? Would your body be remembering experiences that your conscious mind isn't really thinking about anymore because it's behind that wall that we talked about in segment one? I'm here with Dr. Ricky Greenwald, and let's dive in. So we were talking about the wall that we put all of these, the loss, the pain, the normal major trauma, the micro traumas behind so that we could function. But if we've done that for a really long time and it adds up and we have that anxiety you were mentioning beforehand, it could cause other issues. Stress is an exacerbator of illness. It's a precursor to illness. So I'm curious if some of this unresolved emotional trauma could be impacting our immune system or actually altering our physical health.
Yes. I mean, there's mountains of research on this. First of all, just about every mental health or behavioral problem people can have, anxiety, depression, anger, addictions, violence, underperformance at school or work, trauma can either cause or make worse any of that stuff, relationship issues. And then when you get to the medical, you may be familiar with what's called the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that was done by Kaiser in California. And they surveyed thousands of their just patients coming in for medical care. And what they found was a very strong relationship between how many adverse childhood experiences you had and what your medical problems were. And what they found, adverse experiences, including classic trauma things, parents with a serious mental illness or with substance abuse or with violence, et cetera. And the more boxes you could tick off, I had this one, every additional box you tick off increased exponentially your frequency of medical problems, not only the medical problems that are related to high risk behaviors. Like, obviously, if you don't put your seatbelt on, you're going to get more hurt in car accidents. If you smoke cigarettes, you're going to get lung cancer more often. Even when they controlled for behaviors, they found that the more adverse childhood experiences you had, the more at risk you were for every kind of medical problem, even controlling out for the high-risk behaviors. So I think it goes to the body's immune system, the generic stress impact. It's still not fully understood. But yeah, you want to have a better life, clean out that sore spot. You want to have better chance of being healthy, clean out that sore spot. It impacts your thoughts, your emotions, your behaviors, and your health.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And now I'm going to switch and ask a couple of other questions that I know I'm going to get. We've talked a little bit about what's behind that wall and about issues like the example where the child was bumped and he immediately thought he was being attacked. But sometimes it's not a physical thing. Sometimes it's a smell. It's walking into a certain place, like a room, and it instantly brings you back into those emotions that maybe we thought were behind that wall. Can you maybe let us know why sometimes songs or smells or locations can have a similar effect, as the example you had prior?
Well, it's really whatever hits the sore spot. If the guys that did that to you had a red car, maybe it's seeing a red car. I'm just thinking of examples that come into my head of clients I've worked with. If it was the sound of the blood dripping down from the hospital table, it's the sound of drips. Water dripping will do it. It's a reminder. If it's the feeling of helplessness, like that child with a learning disability example I gave, I don't get it. Another situation where you feel helplessness, that could hit the sore spot. So it's just however the brain makes the connection, if something hits the sore spot, it can seem random from the outside.
Okay, so now let's switch to the positive side and healing, because there's a lot of exciting advancements in trauma treatment over the last couple of years. It's continuing to evolve, and your institute has been involved with innovative approaches, EMDR, progressive counting, other evidence-based therapies. Why have therapies changed so dramatically compared to maybe 10, 15 years ago? And what breakthroughs are exciting you the most?
Okay, well, I love to talk about this stuff. So there are two in the mental health field, everybody knows about trauma now. I do a lot of training of mental health professionals, and in a room of 50 people, 30 years ago, I'd say, if you've ever had any trauma training, raise your hand. In a room of 50 people, one or two hands go up. That was 30 years ago. Now I ask the same question, one or two hands don't go up. So in mental health, we get trauma's a big thing because the sore spot drives all the problems. It's not the only thing driving problems, right? People have habits, life situations, temperaments, but it's a big thing, right? So everybody's treating trauma now. What are they doing? There are two main things people are doing. One is helping people manage their symptoms. And that's great because it's way better than not managing your symptoms. So you get medication, meditation, mindfulness, a lot of acronyms, DBT, CBT, self-management skills. And that's all good stuff. But it requires ongoing work. You got to keep on doing it. And it only goes so far because sooner or later, you're going to get it such a big sore spot reaction that your skills go out the window. And so this is helpful, but people can be in and out of therapy their whole life and struggling and struggling, and it only goes so far. So I use that stuff, I teach it, it's good, but it only goes so far. Where the real advances are coming, which is very exciting to me, is in the trauma healing department. Tell you about a study that was done. Tanya Edmond did this some years ago. A bunch of adult women who had been abused as children were randomized to either EMDR, which is a trauma healing method, or CBT, which is a skills training, right? They all got better. Over a few months, the CBT people backslid a little, whereas the EMDR people kept on getting more better. Exit interviews were very interesting. The women who got CBT said, "This was a great treatment. I love it. It really helped me cope with my symptoms." The women who got the EMDR said, this is a great treatment. I love it. It helped me heal so I don't have to cope with my symptoms anymore. So trauma healing, it's been a revolution in the last 30 years or so where we now know how to do it. I mean, before it's like, oh, you're damaged for life. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And now we can say, look, you come in and do the work. We have effective, efficient, reliable ways of helping you kind of take that stuff out from behind the wall and chew it up bite by bite and digest it so that it's not a wound anymore and it's something you've grown from. So
right. Let me ask you a question, because I know people at home are going to be wondering this. Mm-hmm. Maybe people at home have been struggling for 20 years, 30 years, longer, and they're hearing this and they're like, well, I went through CBT. That was great. Is it too late for me to do other treatments that are trauma healing in nature? Is there a point where maybe it's not available for me because it's just been too long?
I had somebody 70 years old who said, oh, I wish I'd done this 50 years ago. And then the next week I had somebody who was 17 years old who said, oh, I wish I'd done this 5 years ago. But you know, you got your whole life ahead of you. Whatever's left, you might as well live it to your potential without all this stuff dragging you down. So I felt the same way as a musician, you know. I would be learning something when I was 20 and somebody else had learned it when they were three. Yeah, they're ahead of me, but I'm only 20. I got a lot of years left. So yeah, you just do the best you can. So the methodology, it's EMDR is the best known of these trauma healing methods. It's got a lot of research support and a lot of celebrity endorsements by now. Miley Cyrus, Prince Harry, Lady Gaga, Sandra Bullock, right? It works. It's really good. And I developed another method called progressive counting that's matched EMDR in three comparison studies. Phil Manfield developed a method called Flash that's a much lighter touch and still getting the job done. And there's other methods as well. Some have more research, some have less. But we're really in a revolution now where people are saying, I don't want to just manage my symptoms. I want to feel better so I don't have those symptoms to manage. It's work, by the way. It's not easy, but it's doable.
That's awesome. We do have to take a brief break, okay. Because we're getting to the end of our segment. So we'll pick up after the break. Folks, this might be one of the most hopeful messages we've heard on this show. It doesn't matter how long you've had it. Healing isn't about erasing your past. It's about changing your relationship with it. And you can actually heal from past trauma and no longer allow that story to control your narrative. Coming up next, millions of people are telling ChatGPT they've never told another human. Should that excite us or should we be concerned? Stick around. Intelligence can write essays, review medical records, and now, is it becoming someone's therapist? Would you trust AI with your deepest fears? Millions of people already are. What happens when the first person who truly listens isn't actually a person? Welcome back to Vital Signs. I'm Jen Godet, your host, and I'm here with Dr. Greenwald, and we have been talking about trauma. We've been talking about really exciting advancements in therapy and healing. But the issue du jour, Dr. Greenwald, is I don't need a therapist. I just use ChatGPT or whatever they're using. When you hear someone say that, what's your first reaction?
Oh, boy. What's yours? Probably the same.
mine is an eye roll. And if you followed me, you know, if you wouldn't put it on a billboard, you shouldn't put it in ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. But I digress.
Right. So, I mean, there is the privacy issue, of course. And there's also, so one of the things I do is I train other mental health professionals. I teach them how to do trauma therapy. And somebody just a couple of days ago asked a question to ChatGPT and brought the answer into our discussion board. And I looked at it, and it was all convoluted and had a lot of good information in there mixed with garbage. And I'm just like, I'm not even going to respond to that. I'll just respond to your question myself. So I think obviously there's a lot of value in artificial intelligence that we're still, as a society, figuring out how to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. I wouldn't want to trust my mental health to that at this stage of its development. I think it's too risky. Also, I think people, and I'm not an expert on AI, but I understand that a lot of the issue is that it reinforces what somebody is saying. So it doesn't necessarily give you the objective feedback or guidance that a therapist might. It may reinforce your existing beliefs, even if those are negative beliefs that are driving you into anxiety or depression. The other thing I would say is that therapy is about, it's not only about providing support or advice. That can be part of therapy. But with the trauma healing methods around now, when you go into a therapist that uses those, that's where you get the profound lasting change. And you can't get that off the internet. You just can't. It guides you through a very personal experience that really needs an expert guide. So I know people are doing it because they're getting something out of it. I just wouldn't trust it myself.
Yep. Well, you know, it's really interesting because I've had several other practitioners and areas of practice on. And one of the things that we discussed, and I think it is worth bearing here, is if you're going to a open source AI, it's scoping the internet. It's not just using medical journals or sound research. It's also looking at Reddit and other sites that are just people putting their opinions in. And so I think there's an element of research and there's an element of making sure that it's credible. And I think that is definitely a distinction, especially as we see AI improving or helping and assisting clinicians to improve overall mental health care. So let me ask you a question, because this is something that comes up very frequently. Where do you believe AI can genuinely improve mental health care or make therapy better? Is it more in the education and training of clinicians, or is it maybe between sessions or education? If somebody doesn't quite understand something, it's a good source. Like where does it fit? Because that question keeps coming up. It's not that it's completely no. Right. It's not that it's completely yes. It's this gray area.
This is where I get to say, I don't have to know everything about everything. And I'm probably not the right person to answer that. It's just not my area of expertise. And there's a good answer, but I don't have it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and say, I don't think AI should never replace a human being. And I think what I heard you say earlier was it's the techniques that are being used by the clinicians that are really essential. And not only that, the human relationship. So let me ask you the question that I know everybody is dying to ask you now. Hey, I'm a parent. My teenager keeps coming to me and saying, no, mom, I don't need a therapist. I already have somebody to talk to. It's insert AI generic here. How would you address that for the parent? Like, how could we as parents respond to that conversation?
Well, I've had that conversation with many parents. If your child had a scratch or a minor cut, would you take them to the hospital? No, just wash it, put a Band-Aid on. If your child had a broken bone, would you take them to the hospital? Absolutely. What if they say they don't want to go? They're going. I'm the parent, right? And so if your child had a bad day at school and got made fun of, would you send them to the therapist? No, I just cheer him up, give him a pep talk, maybe talk about what happened. Okay. If your child has a mental health disorder and is actually anxious or depressed and it's interfering with their daily functioning? Just give them a pep talk, or do they need professional help? Right? And so if they say they don't want to go, well, that's why you're the parent. Because just like if they had a broken bone and they need professional help, if they got a mental disorder that's interfering with their life, they need professional help. Now, the problem is you take them to the therapist, and some therapists will say, oh, well, if they're not motivated, there's no point. That's wrong. That's just like saying if they're depressed, there's no point, or if they're angry, right? That's wrong. Lack of motivation is treatable, just like depression is treatable, etc. But again, not every therapist is the same. So it's a little tricky finding the right therapist for whatever you're going for. But what I would say is that parents are parents because kids don't have the judgment yet.
I would agree with that statement 100% as a prior healthcare practitioner as well, clinician as well. And then I'm going to ask a follow-up to this because I know it's going to come. And that's, okay, so where is the line between this is something that needs professional care versus not in the mental health arena? Because maybe my child comes home and now my child is ill and doesn't want to go to school. They always have a stomach ache. What is that about? Well, sometimes it's stress and they have a test coming up, but if it's happening recurrent, like where is that line when it's not quite so obvious as a broken bone?
Right. Yeah. And mental health stuff. I think it's, if the child tells you, I'm not okay, I need help, that's a good clue. Not every child will say that. If you feel that it's interfering with their normal living or functioning, if they're not making it to school, if they're isolating and not having social interactions anymore, if they're not able to get their schoolwork done or their homework done, if they're becoming so aggressive that people don't feel safe around them, right? So it's crossing the line when it's interfering with what you would consider normal, healthy functioning.
Yeah, that line is definitely a moving target these days.
Yeah, there's judgment there.
Okay, so let me ask you on this spectrum, because I believe we had a little bit more to go, and we only have about a minute and a half before we have to wrap for this segment. But look ahead for me. Look at the next 2, 5 years, maybe even 10. What does therapy look like? How is it evolving with some of the advancements that you mentioned earlier? Where are we going?
The cutting edge is taking all these efficient, effective, well-tolerated trauma treatments and packing them into an intensive. And we've been doing this for years. We are just literally in the next couple of weeks doing a project in a state where Medicaid is going to start paying for intensives, where you get like a year's worth of work done in a few days, working all day, every day with a therapist. We've been doing this for years. We have a grant-funded program in Western Mass. We have people coming from all over the country. And people are solving their problem this week instead of next year, and then living their lives at a higher level. And that's becoming more and more popular. So in trauma therapy, that is the cutting edge.
That's awesome. And we think about this in other arenas, like maybe we go to a wellness retreat or we go to a strength and conditioning camp. But if we're having issues or challenges with trauma, or our children are, this sounds like a really exciting new advancement, having everything done in a couple of days in an intensive, so that we can get back to living life the way we need to.
Yeah.
We do have to take a brief break, folks. And the question that a lot of you have had is technology making us more connected or more emotionally isolated? The reality is it's not a defined line. Tech can make healthcare more accessible, but healing happens through trust, connection, relationships, and under the guidance of your practitioners with researched and effective treatments. So I'd love to know what you think. Would you ever use AI as part of your mental health journey? Connect with me on LinkedIn, join the conversation, share your questions, and tell me what's up. When we come back, we're going to ask one of the biggest parenting questions of our time. Are we raising resilient children, or are we unintentionally raising children who are less prepared for life's inevitable challenges? Stay tuned. Every parent wants to protect their child. Every grandparent, myself included, wants life to be easier for the next generation. But here's the question: can protecting children from every hardship actually make adulthood harder? Parents today spend more time protecting their children than any other generation in history. Yet childhood anxiety has never been higher. Welcome back to Vital Signs. I'm Jen Godet, your fearless host here with Dr. Ricky Greenwald. Let's dive in. Dr. Greenwald, have we started confusing discomfort with danger as parents?
Yeah, every parent wants their child to be okay. And so there's this instinct probably to overprotect. And we certainly don't want to underprotect. We don't want to, you know, leave our kids to wander among the wolves. But so it's trying to find that sweet spot of giving the child enough freedom to get bored, enough freedom to skin their knees, but not so much freedom that they're not being taken care of, right? We want to let our children experience the minor hardships and learn to cope with them with our support, but learn to cope with them and build up resilience rather than protecting them from everything. And then they don't become the strong, capable people we want them to be.
Well, it also, so I'm going to liken this, you mentioned resilience and we'll get back to that. I'm going to also liken this to creative problem solving and critical thinking. Mm-hmm. We've seen a decline in both of those skills, as well as a decline in resilience as we've become more, I call them helicopter moms. I was in sports medicine, so we had helicopter moms. and so how do we help our children become resilient? What exactly is resilience? Can you sort of define that? Because there's a lot of lack of clarity about what resilience actually is and how much we need to be exposed in order to become resilient. Can you sort of shed some light on that?
I don't have maybe the best definition, but I understand it as being somebody who's able to experience adversity and bounce back, rather than just crumbling and giving up. It's okay to crumble and give up as long as you bounce back after that, right? Mm. Nobody has to be perfect. so there are specific things parents can do. One is not protect children from the consequences of their own actions. So for example, one time when my child didn't return something I'd lent her, she wanted to borrow something another time. I said, no, I don't trust you anymore because last time you didn't return it. And she's like, oh, well, how do I get you to trust me again? And we had to figure it out what she could do to earn the trust back, right? So not protecting children from the consequences so they can learn from their experiences. Another thing, and there's research on this stuff. If you praise a child, I mean, we love to praise our children and help them to feel good and recognized and respected and seen. If you praise the child for their accomplishment, that's not necessarily helpful to the child. If you praise them for their effort, for their behavior, that is helpful. So, for example, a child gets a decent grade on a project in school, and you say, wow, that was a great grade, or that's a great thing. That's not so great for the child. If you say, wow, you really worked hard on that, look what you did, that's going to reinforce the behavior you want. Because if you praise the results and then another time they don't get the result, they're more likely to fall apart, give up, crumble. If you praise the behavior regardless of the result, they're more likely to keep doing that behavior. And that's how they build up the effort, the work ethic, the resilience.
Oh,
And
and
there's
I've seen
research
this
on
in
that. Yeah.
sports. Let me give another example. It's the same thing with rewards, right? If we're only rewarding when the child scores a goal, that's not always in their control. They may play an opponent who is a much more effective, efficient team. You know, maybe you're in junior high playing against high school team. There's no way that you're gonna achieve that goal, and then it has a very detrimental effect to their confidence the next go round. So it's even in the way we reward. If we're rewarding the behavior that we want, then that's what's going to be the most helpful, is what I'm hearing. So let me ask you the next question, because this one I really want to make sure we have time to cover. How do parents know when to step in and when to let their child struggle? And I'm thinking of a couple of clear examples. I'm thinking of in middle school when, you know, when the parent is always going to the teacher over every little thing, or when the parent is attending the job interview for the first time for their, you know, 18-year-old child. Like there's some definite places where there's either overstepping or whatnot. So how do we know when to step in, and how do we know when to let them struggle?
Okay, so I would go back farther. You and I both, we share an interest in sports, and you're probably aware that in the last decade or so, parents have started pushing their children to be high achievers much earlier in life. I mean, if you look at Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and all those, they were just kids while they were kids, and it wasn't until college that they got pretty serious about sports. Nowadays, kids are on travel teams when they're 9 years old, right? And in terms of building resilience, a lot of it starts very early with letting kids get bored. That means not giving them the video games and the iPhones and the iPads and the TV, letting kids get bored, letting them have unstructured playtime. And that's where kids much earlier in life start to develop these skills of figuring things out for themselves and how to handle things. And then by the time the scenarios you're describing, I think it's really a judgment call. Is this a safety thing that an adult needs to intervene for? Or am I just trying to smooth my child's path in a way that would actually be better for them if they forged their own path?
That's
But
a
it
great
starts much
question.
earlier.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it dips into some of the other conversations we've had about digital time and everything else as well. So if you're watching, we don't need to dive into that today. We've had several other episodes where we've talked about how much, when should we interject with digital, like how much digital time versus not. So let me ask you, because we have about a minute and a half before I want to make sure everybody knows how they can reach you. A lot of times we see unresolved trauma being passed from one generation to the next. And I'm gonna reference, I don't remember how you put it, but basically, you know, if you grow up with a certain experience, that is your experience moving forward unless you fix that hurt or that wound. Or maybe, you know, if you were a kid who was you know, raised with a little bit of the belt and other things, you associate that with parental love or guidance, and that's not necessarily the healthiest thing to pass on. So how does that trauma get passed on? And not really that. How can we, if we recognize some of these things in ourselves, or how does healing ourselves actually change the trajectory for our children?
Well, first of all, not everybody who is hurt goes on to hurt others. Some do, but some don't. So there's a decision involved, right? So some people will say, I was beaten as a child. I'm never going to do that to my own child. Whereas others will say, oh, yeah, that's how parenting is. I'm going to be a parent, right? So it's not automatic. But I think one thing parents can do is make their own decisions about what kind of parent they want to be. And another thing they can do is back up those decisions by becoming the person they need to be to implement those decisions. Sometimes that involves some coaching on self-control skills so they can handle things the way they want to. Sometimes that involves some of the trauma healing stuff so they can clean out their own sore spot and they don't have a sore spot reaction to their children, and then they can be the parent that they want to be.
That makes sense. And so if you're watching, folks, and you notice that you're in a pattern and you'd like to change that, that's an excellent opportunity to learn more about what we're discussing right here and have a look at what skill sets do I need in order to be that parent that I want to be or the person that I want to be in the next relationship. So we've talked a lot about this. This has been a really excellent conversation. Thank you for your expertise. How can people learn more about your work that you're doing, more if they have questions and they want to reach out, how would you like them to reach out?
Well, we have a website. It's TICTI.org. And we have information for parents. We've got information about people looking for therapy. We train mental health professionals. It's all there. You can read about our research there. It's all there.
Thank you so much for this. It's been a fantastic conversation. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I appreciate you too. I've enjoyed it.
If today's conversation challenged you in the way you think about yourself, your relationships, or your family, I hope you'll carry one thought with you. Instead of asking, what's wrong with me or why am I this way? Perhaps a better question might be, what happened to me and what can I do to change the impact that story is having on my present and my future? Because healing doesn't begin when life becomes perfect. It begins when we become curious enough to understand ourselves with compassion instead of judgment. That's the first step. If you're wondering how do I take the first step? That's the first step. Reach out, learn more. TICTI.org is that website. I'm Jen Godet. Thank you for joining us on Vital Signs, where every week we bring to you the conversations that empower you to take control and protect your greatest asset, your health. See you next time.